www.ecosystemsforhealth.org.
Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Today we have several topics, so I hope you stay tuned for the full show. Joining us later will be Tampa area Congressmember Kathy Castor. We'll talk about Florida's spike in coronavirus cases and how the federal government could help. We'll also hear how Hernando County commissioners responded last week when they were asked to denounce white supremacy. Also in the show, we'll look at how important meals in schools are to reducing school hunger and childhood hunger. And first up, we're going to speak with a guest who is participating in today's strike for Black Lives. Organizers of the National Workers Strike say tens of thousands of people are walking off the job today in more than two dozen U.S. cities, including in Tampa. They're protesting systemic racism and economic inequality that's only worsened during the coronavirus pandemic. The strike for Black Lives includes essential work such as nursing home employees, janitors, and fast food and ride share and airport workers. And the events today target corporations and government leaders. We don't have our first guest on just yet, so we're going to move on, and we'll come back to the strike for Black Lives in just a moment. But right now, I want to turn to a short interview I recorded last week about how important meals in schools are to reduce childhood hunger and how things are changing during the coronavirus pandemic. So here's an interview I recorded last week with Adam Lustig. He's a manager with Trust for America's Health.
Trust for America's Health, welcome to WMNF.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we're going to talk about school meals. So give us an idea of how school meals are changing during the coronavirus pandemic.
Sure. And it's really a pleasure to be here. And school meals have been something that there's been incredible change over the past 4 months as we've been dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. With school closures and with the prospect of potential reopening or questionable reopening plans, there's been a lot of innovation that's been happening at the school district level. And so there have been many school districts across the country that have set up meal feeding sites. There are some school districts, especially those in more rural areas, that have actually utilized their bus service to deliver meals along a regular bus route. And we've even seen some cases of school districts individually delivering meals via bus to students who rely on the very important school and breakfast and lunch programs that provide them with their sometimes sole source of nutritious food.
How many people in Florida, how many kids in Florida participate in meals from school?
So about 58% of children in Florida participate in a free or reduced price lunch program, which would also qualify them for the breakfast program as well. And that equates to about 1.5 million children in Florida. So Florida, as I said, is 58%. The nationally, about 50% of children qualify for free or reduced price lunches.
So for these 58% of Florida students, why do free or reduced lunches at schools matter?
So there's robust evidence that shows the importance of nutritious food on educational outcomes and cognitive development. For these students, many of them come from low-income households and may have difficulty in obtaining nutritious meals. And so, as I said previously, the breakfast and lunch provided by schools is sometimes the only nutritious meals that they have access to.
What about during the coronavirus pandemic? Has that made the need for these free and reduced lunches even more?
I would say so. I think there, as we've seen, just the significant economic impact that the COVID-19 pandemic has played across the country, and we look at potentially more children qualifying for this upcoming school year. And so it's incredibly important that schools continue to adapt to ensure that students can access these meals, but they will need support from their state and federal partners as well. For many of these school systems that are operating these programs, they're only providing free meals. And so they're missing out on all that revenue that they would typically bring in from students who would pay for their meals. And so they've been running at a loss. And so we've been advocating for at the federal level to continue to provide funding to school districts, not only to overcome these financial barriers, but also to ensure the safety of the students who are getting these meals and the wonderful personnel who are providing these services.
Our guest is Adam Lustig with Trust for America's Health, and we're talking about school meal programs. A lot of school districts are either uncertain about opening, and they may delay their reopening in the fall, or there will be some people returning to campuses and some students learning remotely. How will school lunch programs, for example, be impacted by all this uncertainty?
So there's a lot of questions about this, and I think there's rightfully been a focus on thinking about how do we ensure delivery of education to students. But I think there's this underlying issue, which we highlight in our report, is that there are, like I said, over 50% of children in the United States rely on these meals. And so we've seen, at least for this past school year, there is this program created by the federal government called the Pandemic EBT program. And so this is an additional benefit that is provided to families whose children would otherwise qualify for free meals that provides $5.70 per child per school day in order for them to actually have that money so that they can buy those meals outside of school in a grocery store. Because as we look towards the fall, we know that there's many different approaches that school districts are proposing, as you had said, whether that's a hybrid approach of sometimes being in school, sometimes not, completely online. But this pandemic EBT program that was passed as part of the coronavirus relief package only applied to the last school year. And so it does need to be extended into this upcoming school year, in addition to being slightly amended, because as the regulations currently read, schools have to be closed for 5 consecutive days. If we're in a hybrid approach where, let's say, students are only in school 1 week at a time or maybe 2 days a week, this benefit would not apply to them. So that's something that we're advocating for at the federal level.
We are speaking with Adam Lustig. He's with Trust for America's Health. We're talking about school meal programs and how they help students. You've talked about how school meals impact learning, but what about other aspects of children's daily lives, like their health, their physical well-being, their mental well-being? How is having healthy meals important for all of that?
I mean, healthy meals plays a critical role in everyone's life, and it's especially important in children. I think the one area that we focus on as an organization at the Trust for America's Health is childhood obesity. And as I previously said, the school breakfast and lunch programs are sometimes the only nutritious meals that these students have access to. And so rather than going to a convenience store or eating junk food or other unhealthy food, this provides really a lifeline for many families across the country.
Well, those are my questions. Is there anything else that people should know about children's nutrition and what we should be thinking about in making sure that children get all the nutrition they have, even during this time of the pandemic?
I think it's just important to continue to elevate that this is a critical issue. As we focus on returning to school, what those plans look like, there's a significant focus on safety, but there does also need to be this focus on some of the other programs that are delivered through school settings that play a very important role. We highlight a lot of this work, not only in the report that we published today, but also on our organization's website, tfah.org, where we have a whole page that's just specifically related to COVID-19 resources.
Well, Adam Lustig with Trust for America's Health, thank you so much for coming on WMNF today.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
And that was an interview I recorded last week with Adam Lustig, who is a manager with Trust for America's Health. We'll put links to the study on our website, WMNF.org, later in the afternoon. You are listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM. I'm Sean Canaan. Later in the show, we're going to bring on Congressmember Kathy Castor. And you can join the conversation right now by calling 813-239-9663. You can also email DJ at WMNF.org, or you can text 813-433-0885. If you do text, I won't be able to reply to you online, and please put your name on the text. And we hope to have our guest from Strike for Black Lives on later in the show. We hope to hear from him. But right now, we're going to turn to Hernando County and a 10-minute segment from a county commission meeting that happened last Tuesday. And I think you're going to find this interesting. You'll hear how four of the commissioners responded to a request that they denounce white supremacy. And I want to know what you think about their answers. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org. Commission Chair John Mitten didn't respond during this segment, but we'll hear from the other four. And just so you know, all the commissioners are white men. We'll begin with Hernando County Commissioner Wayne Duke's response to whether he will denounce white supremacy. Here's what he and the others said.
All the white supremacists in Hernando County, I have never met one. I don't even know what the definition is. 20 years ago, there was no definition. And now everybody's one if you're white. I don't understand. Where does this end at? These people have the audacity to want us to say some words that's going to make somebody feel good. And we got this thing through the email from the DNC, the local one, basically says that we're bad people because we refuse to denounce white supremacy. Folks, you know, we're all born of whatever race as kind of neutral. If you're a jerk, you worked at it. If you're a robber, if you're a bum, you worked at it, whatever circumstances. I don't get it, folks. I don't get it. This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my 75 years of life. And I grew up in the South. I grew up around bad things, and we took care of it. It went away. It's gone. How can we condemn one thing? We can lock down a whole town and say you can't go outside unless you're a protester and want to go out and burn and loot. That's okay. How is that possible? So if they want me to say something about white supremacists, bring me some up here. Let me hear what they got to say, because I don't know any.
That was Hernando County Commissioner Wayne Duke speaking Tuesday, responding to calls for the commission to denounce white supremacy. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa. This is Hernando County Commissioner Steve Champion.
Mr. Champion.
Thank you, sir. A couple things. First, I'll address the school board member, Linda Prescott, because she's been out in the public saying that it's our responsibility. And she's basically pushing off in her responsibility as a school board member. If you want masks in your school, vote for it and do it, like Commissioner Holcomb said. Fine, you're elected to office. And they're saying that people don't come here to shop. They're actually coming here because we're a constitutional county, and we're not going to make someone on their person wear a mask. That is crazy. I'm going to make you do this. Do you know what? The government's job is to educate you on the possible threat to your person. So you should do whatever you can to reduce that possibility of you catching this virus. Nobody wants you to get this virus, of course. So the school board needs to do their job, and if they decide they want masks, whatever, I guess you decide to do that or not. So getting to the Democratic Party that put out this disgusting article about us, and I believe you guys have all seen this, right? True story that when they were spreading lies about me, I said, do you know that my kids are biracial? And the Democrat Party said, you don't get a pass because your kids are biracial. Are you serious? You know, we talked about this earlier, Commissioner Benton. I know you're involved in a lot of different charitable organizations and stuff. And you know what? It crosses over all kinds of races. You do a great job with that. You know, so it is disgusting, the politics that are being displayed here. And you know what? You're guilty until proven innocent. Of course I denounce racism. And I've worked with diverse people my whole life, all over the state of Florida, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, down in Tampa and Clearwater. You know, a lot of the times I was a minority. When I was in high school, in Fort Lauderdale High School, I was a minority. I mean, white people were a small percentage of the school that I went to. It was mostly Hispanic and African American. So they don't know our history. And until you have something that says that they just label us because of your skin color, that would be like labeling someone that's African American, they're racist because they're African American. Come on. It is really sick. And I tell you that it's all about politics, and that's what all this pushes. The masks are about politics. The Democrat Party is about politics. And by the way, let me remind you that the Democrat Party was the party of the Ku Klux Klan. The Democrat Party was a party of slavery, right? The Republican Party and our first president, Abraham Lincoln, freed the slaves. Let's talk about that, right? So instead, I don't know where the roles got flipped. The Democrat Party is about abortion. They're aborting black and brown babies at a 90% clip of what, you know, there's very few of, you know, the Republicans that are getting aborted. And, you know, they demonize us all the time. It just really makes me mad. I tell you, I'm not a racist. My kids are biracial. And I denounce the Democrat Party for putting that garbage out there for the public to see.
That was Hernando County Commissioner Steve Champion speaking Tuesday, responding to calls for the commission to denounce white supremacy. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa. This is Hernando County Commissioner John Alaco.
Commissioner Alaco.
It's frustrating to see where we are as a society. Nothing you say will matter. Because it's not a, I think it was you who mentioned that you can't prove a negative. You can't prove what you're not. You can only prove what you are. Okay? I'm an American. I'm a father. I'm a grandfather. I'm a grandfather of biracial children. My son-in-law is not Caucasian. I love him to death and I love my grandkids to death. Doesn't matter though, because I can't prove that to you that I don't not love them. Since this situation occurred, someone mentioned the white supremacist who came from another county. He came here because he couldn't count on white supremacists from Hernando County to show up. Okay, we denounced him from this board when it happened. We said, the guy was an idiot. Come here and try to cause problems in here. We praise the people who protested even because they didn't get involved. They stayed away. Our police did a fantastic job. Hernando County Sheriff's Department did a fantastic job. I've personally been involved with a group called the Bridge Builders. Been to multiple meetings there. We got Reverend Emery Ailes is here today. He could vouch for it if you want him to vouch for it. I've been involved with our black community for years trying to build bridges to the community. Why? Because I believe in my own heart that racism is wrong. But I don't do it just because it's my opinion. It's because I believe that God stated. It's in his word. It's in Acts. It's in Romans. It's in Colossians. He says God is no respecter of persons. Okay, that means it doesn't matter what your color is. Doesn't matter where you came from. Doesn't matter how tall you are, how short you are. Okay? You want me to say it? It won't matter. I'm going to say it anyway just because it'll come back in another email. Because nobody's listening anyway. I denounce all racial supremacy. I denounce all racism. I denounce any law or ordinance that gives somebody a special privilege because of their race or their color. I'm saying it won't matter any because I'm still going to get emails. There's still going to be things that are placed on Facebook because it's not about fixing a problem. It's a heart problem. That's why I'm working with that group. Okay. That's why I'm encouraging the leaders, the faith-based leaders who actually have a foundational belief that God said it. That's why they believe it. Not because it's convenient in an election cycle. Okay. But you know what? It's a heart problem. It's going to change one person at a time. It's going to change only by how you live your life and how you raise your children and your grandchildren. Okay. Somebody up here is not going to make a difference. Okay. To the community as a whole, we're going to make a difference in our home with the people that God gave us the ability to speak into their lives. Okay. I denounce it. This board has denounced it before. You want to hear the specific words? I said it. Okay? But in the end, you have to be willing to change, okay? There's a scriptural verse that says, why do you point this speck out in your brother's eye when you have a plank in your own? We got a lot of planks out there. They're usually the ones who are putting this stuff on Facebook, walking around with planks in their eyes while they're picking the specks in their brother's eyes out. Fix your own life. Get it right. We'll worry about our families. We'll do it one church at a time, one family at a time. That's my opinion on supremacy and racism.
Thank you.
That was Hernando County Commissioner John Alaco speaking Tuesday, responding to calls for the commission to denounce white supremacy. You're listening to Midpoint on WMNF Tampa. This is Hernando County Commissioner Jeff Holcomb.
Commissioner Holcomb, you are now recognized.
So I was going to do this during my time, but it seems like this is the best time. So for those of you following along at home or have just arrived in our chambers, there's a Facebook post that I became aware about yesterday, and it says, from the Hernando County Democrat Party, Black Lives Matter. With white supremacists feeling emboldened, we need leaders who will say unequivocally that their hate is not welcome in our home. And then that's why you've got your email campaign that was expressed earlier here and read. So let's talk about supremacy and where it come from. We know that the Democrat Party was a party of slavery. The party of Robert K.K. Byrd, in office for 51 years, with every federal building in the state of West Virginia, that might be an exaggeration, named after him. Where's the rebuke? The party that fought against civil rights for 100 years. The party that supports Margaret Sanger. Do you want her quote? We do not want the word to get out that we don't want, that we want to exterminate the Negro population. Margaret Sanger from Planned Parenthood. Woodrow Wilson segregated the federal government. Fired a lot of blacks, also back the Ku Klux Klan. Franklin Delano Roosevelt put in housing discrimination rules with the New Deal. Four Democrats voted for the 13th Amendment to abolish slavery. The rest were Republicans. 14th Amendment granted citizenship to slavery. Democrats responsible for Jim Crow laws in the South. Al Gore Sr. opposed civil rights. Jimmy Carter supported legislation in Georgia to destroy civil rights. Ladies and gentlemen, the history of the Republican Party was brought about by anti-slavery. President Lincoln was the history of this party. But it wrote, you know what? It's about love. Hate is not going to heal hate. It's going to come from love. And I have a special message for Terrence Truax. You're apparently the chairman of the Democrat Executive Committee. I'm the chairman of the Republican Executive Committee. You owe this board an apology now. Thank you.
Well, that was Hernando County Commissioner Jeff Holcomb. Earlier, we heard from three other commissioners, John Olaco, Steve Champion, and Wayne Dukes. What do you think about their responses to a request that they denounce white supremacy? You're listening to WMNF Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Don't forget, later on in the show, we're going to hear from Congressmember Kathy Castor. And if you're on hold right now, please just hold on, because I'm going to come to you in just a minute, but I do want to go to my guest. Organizers of the National Workers' Strike say tens of thousands of people are walking off the job today in more than two dozen U.S. cities, including Tampa. They're protesting systemic racism and economic inequality that have only worsened during the coronavirus pandemic. The strike for Black Lives includes essential workers such as nursing home employees, janitors, fast food, rideshare, and airport workers. The events target corporations and government leaders. Joining us by phone right now is our guest, Trayvon Williams. He's a 19-year-old, and he's worked at Checkers in Tampa for 4 months and makes $8.85 an hour. Welcome to WMNF's Midpoint Monday, Trayvon.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for joining us. Before we get to today's strike for Black Lives, why don't you tell our listeners what your job is like? What do you do at Checkers?
Well, technically, I'm a cook. And at the moment, it's pretty steady. But before, when the coronavirus first started going around, it was really, really hectic because the upper people, like the TM and the department managers and things like that, they didn't really know how they were going to do the job. We really didn't have no protective equipment for the coronavirus, didn't have any hand soap or anything like that. But now everything's getting pretty back steady and right, I can say. So I guess it's pretty good for the most part. It's a fast food job.
And you are striking today for J20, the strike for Black Lives. Tell us why you're doing that and what it will be like.
Well, I'm going to strike today because we all want the same thing. We all want for our families and communities to be healthy, safe, and that's why we all need to come together and work. Like, okay, so basically it's like, we all want to be safe, we all want the same thing, and we all just want the community to be great again. So I feel as if we all want that, we all need to come together from different backgrounds and across from different nations and demand that change so we can have the power. Because when we have power, the most power is in the union, or when we together and not really as in one.
And in addition to the union, you're also looking for a $15 an hour minimum wage. How would having a $15 an hour wage help you?
Honestly, for me, speaking for myself and probably a lot of other people in my shoes, Working for $885 an hour, I pay a $1,200 rent. I'm not even going to bluff you. And that's hard. Got a bunch of behind every day trying to make sure that you work over 40 hours or over 50 hours just to get a decent paycheck to have half your rent or just about everything. But if we had that $15 an hour, it would help better when it comes down to paying bills, and it would also be better just to live off of. Because the livable wages now, people can barely live off of it.
So far, we mostly talked about your working conditions and your wages, but there's a tie-in with the strike for Black Lives between workers and the connection to the Black Lives Matter movement. What's that connection?
Could you repeat that question again? I can't really hear you, so I kind of panicky.
Yeah, my question is, first of all, I should tell our listeners that we're speaking with Trayvon Williams. He is with Strike for Black Lives. He is a worker at Checkers, and he makes $8.85 an hour. And it's called Strike for Black Lives. What's the connection between your strike and the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, the connection between my strike and the Black Lives Matter movement is because, okay, for one, I'm on strike today because I feel like if nowadays it's a lot of craziness going on in the world with the Black Lives and also with the whole working life as well too, because due to the coronavirus. But I feel like Black people are losing their lives in our community and in our workplace, so that's why, in my opinion.
And my last question for you, Trayvon, is how has the coronavirus pandemic affected your working, affected your job, but also affected your finances?
You say how did, I can't really hear you, sir.
I apologize. I'm asking you how the coronavirus has affected your finances and your work.
Okay, so, and that would take back in the place of with the whole workplace part of my job at Checkers. Okay, so it like with the coronavirus, it lowered my hours, and it made everything very difficult for work because we had to close at a certain time, we had to be out of there by a certain time. Certain the ways that we used to work at my job, we can't work anymore due to the coronavirus. Because like at Checkers, if you're not familiar with it, most Checkers have a little place where you can walk up and order food. At my job, we can't even take those orders. We got like glass things blocking our windows so we better can hear the people when they are ordering or when they're trying to pick up their food. It's hard to give out that food. So it's like with the coronavirus, we really came in and changed things. And with my job, it's hard for them to keep up with the right equipment that they need, like soap, hand sanitizer, gloves, and masks, and things like that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming on WMNF's Midpoint today, Trayvon.
Well, thank you as well. I'm very happy for you guys having me.
Thank you so much. Trayvon Williams has worked at a Checkers in Tampa for 4 months. He makes $8.85 an hour, and he is participating in today's national strike for Black Lives. You're listening to WMNF's Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Remember, shortly we'll bring on Congressmember Kathy Castor to talk about the death of her colleague John Lewis, also to talk about Florida's spike in coronavirus cases. But right now we're going to take your calls. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can phone 813-239-9663. You can also email dj at WMNF.org. You can text 813-433-0885. Do we still have Liz from Spring Hill on the line? Hi, Liz. Thanks for joining the show.
I'm calling in reference to the Hernando County Commissioner's statement on white supremacy. I am a resident of Hernando County. I'm also a member of the elected member of the Democratic Party up here.
So what's the background? It sounds like the Democratic Party wanted the commissioners to denounce racism, and we heard the results. Some maybe kind of halfway there. What are your thoughts? Did they denounce white racism during what we heard?
I have to take their words at face value and that they mean them. However, let's, you know, look at their actions. And I find it very interesting that they, you know, this took several weeks or a month to make these statements. And this was under the pressure of the, you know, the chair of our Hernando County Democratic Party asked them directly, and they refused until you started writing about it and having information about it. I think it's a half-hearted effort, and all they're doing is pointing fingers back at the Democratic Party like we're evildoers. This is not going to get us anywhere, and that's why we're starting to put up Democrats here to run for commission and take, you know, this area has a very, very dark history of racism. Our schools are still largely segregated. When they say I have biracial children and I have, you know, minorities as relatives, that doesn't, you know, in that doesn't give you a pass. Well, you know, Andrew Jackson had minority relatives too, but he was still a racist and a segregationist. So let's see what things happen. But we're getting very active here because we're tired of this in this area, and it's just people don't understand. We have to have uncomfortable conversations about our white privilege and how we see things through very different rose-colored glasses. I would love to send each of the commissioners a copy of Carol Randall Williams's You Want a Confederate Monument? My body is a Confederate monument. I think they need to be more educated and have more conversation, but I think it's a start.
All right, Liz, thank you so much for calling. Liz from Spring Hill, we appreciate it. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. This is Midpoint Monday, and pretty soon we're going to be joined by Representative Kathy Castor, a Congress member from the Tampa area, and I'm told that she might be a minute or two late because they're having a moment of silence for Congress member John Lewis on the floor of the House, and so, but she will be joining us, we believe, and so she'll be on pretty soon. Right now we're talking about the Hernando County Commission and whether the commissioners will renounce white racism, or white supremacy, that is. We also have heard from a guest who talked about the strike for Black Lives that's happening today. And you can join any of this conversation, 813-239-9663. You can email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. And I want to go to PolitiFact. And Ben Carson in 2015 said, and this is when he was running for president, he said in New Hampshire, he said, birth control pioneer Margaret Sanger believed that people like me should be eliminated. And PolitiFact ruled, this is going back to what one of the, related to what one of the commissioners said, and this PolitiFact rates that statement false. And they look at the question, did Margaret Sanger believe African Americans should be eliminated? And, you know, you can look that up in PolitiFact. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but essentially that's not an accurate characterization. So, thank you to Rob for forwarding me that PolitiFact article. And we have some other things I'd like to read. Let's see. Actually, let's go right now to Les in Brooksville. Les, you're in Hernando County. What do you think about what your commissioners were saying earlier?
It doesn't surprise me, Sean. It really doesn't. I was born in this town, and fortunately I didn't grow up here. I didn't go to school here. Went away when my father got a transfer. My mother was a mermaid and moved away, and then she wanted to come back, and she moved back here, and I sort of followed her. I went to Tampa, I went to USF, et cetera. So I'm well grounded here, but I see the problem. My grandfather was of Spanish descent. He immigrated here from Venezuela. I'm sorry, Ecuador. He was from Ecuador. And he stole hats in Ybor City, and we used to go to the Silver Ring Cafe on the weekends, and, you know, it was a beautiful time. But the man worked his butt off, and he couldn't even get a bank account in Brooksville because he was Spanish. And that kind of thing just prevails here. You know, it all goes back to the old days when the two brothers, and I'll mention their name, they're the McKeithens. One was a banker and one was a miner. And they pretty much dominated the scene here. Of course, if the miner wanted property to do more mining, he had good contact with his brother, the banker. You know, the same banker that wouldn't give my grandfather a bank account. And you look back at the history of this county, and you can see, well, the oak tree in front of the courthouse. You know, a lot of the Black Lives Matter people wanted it taken down because it's notorious for being a hanging tree for lynching. And that goes way back, okay? So this county is fraught with problems. It's it basically goes back to the deep roots of the Old South. You know, they didn't have fence laws here. In the early 50s, you could be downtown at the courthouse doing business and somebody's cow would be walking through the street. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah, I appreciate you calling in, Les. Thanks so much for giving us that perspective from Brooksville. Thank you. Yeah,
well, listen, pal, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same around here. And I'm not surprised at all that these commissioners won't stand up and adamantly oppose white supremacy. Doesn't surprise me a bit. And I could go on, but you've got other callers, but if you want me to continue, I will.
I'm going to move on, but thank you for calling, Les. I'm going to read an email or two, then we'll go to Jesse in a minute. This person who goes by Pale Skin in Hernando says, if you're a politician in office and you're asked to denounce racism, you should not be offended by saying you should simply do so. It's not that hard to reassure the people where they stand. We don't believe in either party. They made it sound difficult to say. My people are weak for lack of knowledge, and this person signs off saying BLM and peace and stay strong. So thank you for that email out there from up north in our northern area. Also, Jeff writes, I'm starting to wish we didn't have political parties because it's almost becoming like a team sports situation. You have to have allegiance to your team no matter what. You wind up losing sight of a very important issue such as racism. Let's get rid of political parties and have honest discussions and debates about issues one at a time. I think it would make a better country. So that's from Jeff. And I want to remind people that you're listening to 88.5 FM, WMNF Tampa, WMNF.org. You can phone in your comments to 813-239-9663. You can also email us at dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. We're talking about Hernando County commissioners who were asked to renounce white supremacy. Earlier we talked with someone who was from the Strike for Black Lives. And very soon, we're going to have Democratic Congressmember Kathy Castor join us from Washington, D.C. As soon as she has a vote, they're taking a vote right now in Congress, but she's going to join us shortly. So we'll go later to Vinny, but right now we'll go to Jesse in Spring Hill. Hi, Jesse. Welcome to WMNF.
Hello.
Hi, Jesse.
How's it going today?
I'm doing great. What's on your mind?
The white privilege thing. I'm a white guy myself, and I personally ain't got white privilege me myself. I've worked hard for everything I ever got. And it seems to me black people are getting treated better nowadays, getting disability, food stamps, everything else.
Jesse, you just said that black people get disability and all these other things. I think that's something that pretty much everyone can get.
Yeah, as long as you go out and get a job and work hard, you get what you want.
If you have your radio on, you might want to turn it down.
Oh, yeah, I do.
All right, so Jesse, why don't I let you finish and then we can move on. But what else is on your mind?
Oh, no, not much. That was it.
All right. Well, I appreciate that call, Jesse, from Spring Hill. So you're okay with how the commissioners in your county answered that question. Thank you so much. Let's go now to Vinny. Vinny, where are you calling from? Palm Harbor, right?
Dunedin. Dunedin, Sean. Right. Great to hear you, and thank you for all your good work.
Appreciate it.
I had a thought. Yeah, you're welcome. Love your work, and I love the station. I had a thought. I read an article today comparing Reagan's brand of racism and Trump's, and I was thinking that maybe one of the good things that has come all this horrible turmoil the country's going through is this kind of brand of racism is much more out in the open, whereas before with Reagan and his ilk, it was dog whistle stuff that actually caused many of these so-called Republicans to quit the Democratic Party and join the party, so-called party of Lincoln. I think it's really disingenuous of these Hernando County guys to even take that stance that the Democratic Party was the party of the KKK, when obviously their forebears in the state and in government in Florida, particularly Hernando County, was one of the most violently racist counties in Florida, could ever claim that that the Republican Party is somehow not the party of white privilege and the party that is making most of the noise when it comes to divisiveness. And it's just disgusting that they would actually make that comparison. The Democratic Party has proven to be the progressive party, and the Republican Party, the regressive party. And the fact that, and the other guy that was talking about abortion and that kind of an argument, they're willing to legislate my morality, but they're totally in denial about their own amorality. I just find it disgusting, and I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
You know, I don't like to share my thoughts a lot, but I have to say, when you were saying that, the one thing that really struck me during those arguments, when people were saying, well, 130 years ago, this party was like that, and that party was like this, I really felt that was, I mean, I'm not going out on a limb here and saying that was kind of a deflection. The point was, what's happening right now, and, you know, we don't necessarily, in this case, need a history lesson to get to the point of, what's happening right now and how do you feel about it? And I don't think any of the four of them really answered that question.
No, they definitely avoided the topic as best they could, but that convoluted argument that somehow the Democrats were the party of, well, yes, but now those Democrats are sitting in your chair, pal. That's basically how I feel about it, and I don't know if I'd be far off the mark with that.
All right, I appreciate you calling in, Vinny. Thank you so much.
You bet. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. And very soon we're going to have Congressmember Kathy Castor joining us on the phone. But right now, let's go to Teresa in St. Petersburg. Hi, Teresa. What would you like to say?
I would like to make a comment about the history of the Democratic Party. I'm a Democrat, and I know that the Democrats were the racist party. They were the KKK until, what, 1964 or 5, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. Then the party flipped to, you know, being more diverse and welcoming everybody. And then the Republican Party started to try to suppress the Black Americans. They became the more racist party. The KKK went there. And when you have a president that says white supremacists are very fine people, this is what we get right now. This is where we're at right now. So that, you know, that's the history lesson. That one guy wanted to know, Lyndon Johnson, and since then, the Republicans have been trying to figure out how to get rid of the Civil Rights Act. And they gutted the voting part, what, in 2012 or 13? You know?
Yeah, I hear you, Teresa. Yeah.
Yep.
Great. Thanks so much. I appreciate you calling in, Teresa. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. This is WMNF's Midpoint, and you can call in 813-239-9663. You can email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. If you do text us, put your name on the text, please, and just know that I won't be able to respond to you individually later if I don't get to your text on the air. Well, let's go now to Matthew in Sarasota. What's your perspective, Matthew?
I am so happy that your last two callers called in, and I was itching. The whole time I listened to that, all I could think of was Barry Goldwater's statements about the evangelicals taking over the GOP in 68. And it's pretty common knowledge now that most of the Southern Democrat races jumped ship, like she was saying, with Lyndon B. Johnson. In that 68 election, it really solidified it. And what else did we have going on then? We had the race riots, Vietnam, all over again. I feel like they've really woke up some of that stuff that was hidden from that time, and here we are dealing with the same thing we tried to run away from a long time ago. It never left. None of the racism, none of the Southern thinking, no matter how genteel they try to make it. So I'm so glad everybody called in as well. I was just flabbergasted by this false switch of, and like she said, you know, there were racists in the Democrat Party, but they followed their team in the 60s. So that's my opinion.
All right, great.
And those
Thank
guys
you, Matt.
Didn't answer that, really.
Yeah, so let me ask you a follow-up there, if you don't mind. Some of them said things that were kind of close to I denounce white supremacy, but no one really said that. They said, like, I denounce racism in general, or I denounce racism of all kinds, and then they kind of implied, you know...
It's very common. It's the same thing that I grew up with. My sister had mixed children, and my grandfather sat us down with a 2x4 and paced in front of us and told us how we would have been hung in the old days. I would have been hung along with them for supporting them. And I just couldn't believe it. And there were little comments and things the whole time growing up here, because I've grown my whole life here in Florida. And it has been systemic inside of it. So these little things that they do, and it seems to that, I hate to do this, but it seems to they congregate in certain kinds of churches and venues where they come and speak these slights to other races and make themselves feel like they aren't racist, but they're actually just saying, oh, I like black people over there, and I like brown people to be in their job over there, and they don't mix with us really, but I love them. So it's like a subtle thing they were doing, and it's been systemic here our whole lives. So it's good this is all coming out. I hope we get through this time.
Matthew in Sarasota, thank you so much for calling in. And right now we're going to turn to our final guest, Tampa area Democratic Congressmember Kathy Castor is on the line. Welcome back to WMNF's Midpoint, Congressmember Castor.
Hi, Sean. I'm me on.
Thanks for joining us. And let's start just with the news of the death of your colleague in Congress, John Lewis. Why don't you take some time right now just to remember his contribution to civil rights?
Well, he was a humble public servant, and I just came from the floor of the House of Representatives where we had the first, we'll have many tributes to him. We had a moment of silence, and there wasn't a dress in the House, but he, you know, people will know him as an icon. They know him from his struggle for voting rights, being beaten by a white mob on the Edmund Pettus Bridge over 50 years ago. But he was such a down-to-earth, approachable person, and my favorite memories will always be on interacting with young people and kids who would often look up at him and wonder, gosh, should I approach him? And he would go up to them and encourage them on. And but he was he's known as the conscience of the Congress, and for good reason. He urged us on so many fights for equality. I will remember how he led the march across the street on the day we were coming to vote on the Affordable Care Act for universal health care. I will remember very well the sit-in on the floor of the House of Representatives. That was that happened when we all returned to Washington after the Pulse nightclub massacre, and we were just fed up with the GOP continuing to block any vote on a measure to end gun violence. So he called a bunch of us into his office that evening that the Congress after Pulse, and we, true to form, he said, we can't let this stand. We have to do something. And that is when he determined that the next morning the House went into session, that we would begin a peaceful sit-in protest. And the GOP didn't like it. Paul Ryan was Speaker, and rather than give us a vote, he instead adjourned the House. They turned off the C-SPAN cameras. But that didn't matter because we could use. And in fact, C-SPAN and other networks picked up our live stream from the floor as we sat in to demand a vote on to end gun violence. That's just one example. And then it was just a few years ago, he was in St. Petersburg at the Poynter Institute with the Nobel Prize committee, and he gave remarks there. And big crowd, he had everyone. But in the end, his message was, if you see something wrong, you have to stand up and speak out about it. And so I think the most important thing we can do now, in his memory, is to move forward on voting rights. Everyone needs to vote in this election, and the Congress has got to update the Voting Rights Act. We passed a new Voting Rights Act here a few months ago. It's been sitting in the graveyard of Mitch McConnell. And if anyone wants to do something for John Lewis's memory besides voting, it's call Senator Rubio, call Senator Scott, and tell them it's past time to update the Voting Rights Act here in America.
Our guest on WMNF's Midpoint is Tampa area Democratic Congressmember Kathy Castor. And speaking of voting, in November there's expected to be a lot of mail-in votes. What can Congress do to shore up the U.S. Post Office in the time between now and the election?
Well, there are a number of things. In the CARES Act, that was one of the emergency aid bills passed to address the coronavirus, the Congress appropriated significant funds to our supervisors of elections across the country. The state of Florida, unfortunately, was slow to get those funds out, but they have now arrived, and they are going to use those monies to make sure that people can vote by mail. They have the supplies when you go in early vote to stay safe. Now, in the next emergency aid package that we will be negotiating here over the coming weeks, we will put the post office, stabilization of the post, and more resources for safe voting, vote at home across America. We already passed it in the House in the HEROES Act. That is our next emergency aid package. We passed that in May. We've been waiting for the U.S. Senate to come to the table to negotiate. It appears that they're going to do that. But again, this is an important time to weigh in with Florida's U.S. senators and explain that you value the post office. It's especially important during this time of COVID that people can vote safely and that the post office continues uninterrupted.
Today, for the sixth day in a row, Florida recorded more than 10,000 new coronavirus cases, and 90 more Floridians have died. Congressmember Castor, why is Florida among the worst places in the world for the COVID-19 pandemic?
Florida, unfortunately, has had a colossal failure in leadership, and it starts at the top. And President Trump has a lot to must shoulder the blame here, as Governor Ron DeSantis must. They've downplayed the pandemic, said it would disappear. Ron DeSantis was entirely too defensive from the very get-go. They are ignoring our public health experts and ignoring scientists. And in fact, there have been a lot of reviews in the media over the past few days. I encourage folks to go read it, how it was a strategy in the White House to turn away, to avoid any responsibility, to say the states should take responsibility for it. And that strategy has now cost lives, unfortunately. Of course you need the federal government helping to direct supply chains and testing. Of course you need to trust public health experts like Dr. Fauci and others. But rather than that, they have put their personal political fortunes ahead of people's lives. And what we have to do now, since there's such a lack of leadership in the White House and out of Tallahassee, we all have to take personal responsibility to do everything we can to keep our families safe, to listen to our public health experts. Lives truly depend on it. I'm hearing from our local hospitals all across the Tampa Bay area. They have staffing shortages. They have supply shortages.
And I'm sorry to cut you off, Congressman Kathy Castor, but we are out of time. But thank you so much for coming on the show. And I want to thank my other guests, too. You're listening to WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. Thank you so much for listening to WMNF Midpoint Monday.
Thanks, John.
Thanks.